The Tom Woods Show, episode 2325.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am so delighted to have with me two previous guests, guests I hold in very, very high esteem, Connor Boyack and Corey DeAngelis. In the old days, Connor was my tech guy. I keep comparing it to, maybe some of the oldsters will get this reference, but in the old days, Michael McDonald used to sing backup for Steely Dan. Michael McDonald sang backup for Donald Fagen, who can half the time barely get the note right. And then he was able to spread his wings as Michael McDonald. And so the same thing happened with Connor Boyack. Now he's got the Libertas Institute in Utah doing all kinds of great libertarian things around the country. He's got the Tuttle Twins children's book series, many other books to his credit. Corey DeAngelis is the education guy in terms of school choice, and it's not even close. He's on every TV program. He's blocked by every bad guy. He's got every credential you can imagine. And we're going to add to that this book that the two of them have written together called Mediocrity, 40 Ways Government Schools Are Failing Today's Students. So I'm very glad to have you both here. I would say welcome, gentlemen, but then you'll both say, well, thank you, we're over each other, so we won't do that. So anyway, let's get to some questions. First of all, since I really like the work both of you do, I'm just curious, how did the project get started? You became friends at some point, you decided to do it. How'd this happen?
So Corey and I have known each other for years and been at the same conferences and so forth, but never really worked directly together in any professional capacity outside of our efforts at Libertas Institute to pass an education savings account in Utah. And Corey, who's with the American Federation for Children, works all over the country helping states pass these laws. So we had interacted a lot on that particular issue. This particular project, this book, was an idea that I got while walking my dogs last fall. I'm like, hey, that 40th anniversary is coming up in April. Hey, you know, it'd be fun to do a book. Hey, it'd be fun to do a book with Corey. So I call Corey, I pitch him on the idea. I think within like 48 hours, we had a signed agreement and we were off to the races. So pretty fun.
Yeah, I think it also started because of a tweet. I had tweeted something with like the learning loss from the school closures or something. And then you had quote tweeted me about the rising tide of mediocrity, was a quote from the Nation at Risk report. And then we shortly thereafter had that phone call. I remember I was on the road in an Uber during our conversation. I was like, all right, let's do this. And then, pretty quickly afterwards, we had the book completely written.
And the timing is great because the skepticism of the current system, which, let's be honest with ourselves, is still not at levels we'd like to see it at. If I go to the typical town, nobody's really thinking about big picture issues. But more people than ever, I think, are looking around at their options. And more than ever, there increasingly are options. And that's in large part, frankly, I think, because of the efforts of you in particular, Corey. But I think it really is a matter of this book and your efforts are coming at such an opportune moment. Because I think the COVID thing, of course, well, let's get into that, actually. Let you guys answer that. Corey, in particular, what specifically was it about the COVID response that has yielded this particular auspicious moment for, let's say, school reformers?
Yeah, look, the school closures hurt kids in a lot of ways, mentally, academically, physically, but there was a silver lining. And for this, we should really thank Randy Weingarten and the teachers unions for overplaying their hand and awakening a sleeping giant, parents who just want more of a say in their kids' education. What happened was families who thought that their kids were in great public schools, maybe their kid was in an A-rated school by the state, or maybe their kids were coming home with high ranks on their standardized math and reading scores, these same parents started to see another dimension of school quality that I would say is much more important than anything that could be captured by a standardized test, which is whether the school's curriculum aligned with the family's values. Schooling is an extension of parenting. And parents started to see that their kids were being raised by their enemies, people that did not like them. And that's more likely to mobilize parents for change than anything else. So we should really give Randy Weingarten an award for being the unintentional school choice champion of the past 3 years award. And since then, we've been going gangbusters in the states. Six states, at least in the past 2 years, have gone all in on school choice, including Connor State of Utah.
Well, and speaking of my state, given that that's my experience, we had been trying to do school choice stuff for several years. Utah was actually a leader on school choice about 15 years ago, passing a voucher law, and the teachers union spent about $2 million to overturn it via a referendum. So for a decade plus, legislators in my state didn't want to touch school choice because they felt like, oh, the people have spoken, and oh, the teachers union hates it. And so then COVID happens, everything changes, polling numbers go through the roof for parents who now support it for the reasons Corey mentioned, and we were able to pass a comprehensive universal program to allow parents to send their children to education alternatives. So COVID was horrible in so many ways, but there are massive silver linings on that dark cloud, and the widespread increase in support for education freedom is certainly one of them.
Let's dwell for just one more moment on the Randy Weingarten issue. She really is the public face of the teachers' unions. And it is fascinating to me how much she has tried to portray herself. And just as we predicted, by the way, that someday people will say, I never had anything to do with that. I was not in favor of closing things down. But the thing is, the internet is forever. I don't have to go back into the library and dig up microfilm copies of the New York Times. This is all widely available. And when she tries to portray herself as somebody who was desperate to keep schools open, now on Twitter, they have these community notes where everybody links to what she actually said. It's unbelievable.
Yes, in the past 3 days alone, she has changed her pinned tweet after her congressional testimony where she gaslighted the entire nation nonstop, trying to say, oh, we've been fighting to open school since April of 2020. Well, one, if you were really trying to do that, why were you like the only sector in the economy that wasn't open? Why were the private schools open? Why were the private businesses fighting as hard as possible against the government to reopen, whereas the teachers unions were fighting for the opposite? Well, it was obvious. They were holding children's education hostage to secure multiple multi-billion dollar ransom payments from the taxpayer, and it worked for them. But look, I mean, yeah, when Trump was pushing to reopen schools, she called it reckless, callous, and cruel. You had even in Florida, they were suing DeSantis when DeSantis was trying to reopen schools. The union unsuccessfully sued DeSantis to try to keep the schools closed. Randy's union threatened safety strikes in the summer of 2020. And you had her local affiliates like the Chicago Teachers Union with their board member vacationing in Puerto Rico in person while railing against going back to work in person. You had that same union that had to delete a tweet after they were saying that the push to reopen schools, they said, is, quote, rooted in racism, sexism, and misogyny. I mean, they threw everything at the wall to see what would stick, to try not to go back to work. And this is really, this is blowing up in Randy Weingarten's face right now, because no one's falling for the BS gaslighting that she's trying to repeat. Just because you keep repeating the lie doesn't mean it's going to, that anybody's going to believe, because we do have the receipts, and thank goodness for community notes holding her accountable. I think the best way to hold her accountable, though, is through the school choice victories that we've been seeing. Defund her corrupt union that locked kids out of schools for over 2 years in some places. Let the money follow the child to private alternatives so that Randy doesn't have as much power.
Also, I think teachers' unions, if you'd asked people about them, let's say 4 years ago, they probably would have been indifferent to positive, just assuming that probably they're just trying to do what's best for teachers, which in turn will be what's best for students. Not necessarily. That's not necessarily the case. And I interacted, well, the interaction was entirely one-sided. I got no response, but I interacted with somebody in some kind of Chicago teachers union. You can imagine what that would be like. And they were complaining about some libertarian group that was doing this, that, or the other thing. And it was all complaints about the interests of the teachers. And I simply inserted myself into the conversation to say, how are the math scores these days? Like, can we focus on actually how the kids are doing? Because in Chicago, I read some statistic that I'm sorry I've forgotten, where some extraordinary number of schools had literally zero students being proficient in math. How about we talk about that instead of whether or not you get to take as many vacations as you did before, or whatever it is you're complaining about?
I mean, Tom, you certainly understand the economic angle of what happens with any monopoly where costs go up and quality declines because the institution, the particular company that has the monopoly status, faces no real threat of competition. They're not pressured by the market forces and others nipping at their heels. They're not worried about losing market share. So we've seen that with Chicago and everywhere else. These schools, these teachers, these huge waves of administrators that are being hired for who knows what. And it doesn't trickle down to academic proficiency. If you look at the school districts that spend the most money, they're often the worst off, right? So there's no correlation or certainly not causation between the amount of money we're throwing at the system and how the kids are actually doing. And what happens is these teachers' unions are turning the kids into political props. The school industry has become a jobs program for adults in the name of serving kids, but in this kind of like abstract sense, not in any kind of actual sense, for reasons, as you point out, that we're not seeing the test scores, not that standardized tests are like the perfect way to assess the quality of someone's education, but they're a useful metric. And even those are declining. Compare America to the top 10 economic powerhouses across the world. We're at the bottom for educational attainment. And so you have to ask yourself, like, it's that colloquial definition of insanity, right? To keep doing the same thing over and over and expect different results. And so if we want different results, if we want improved education and not having the system pump out all these ignoramuses who become voters, we have to do something differently. And that's why Corey and I are so passionate about exposing the system to some competitive forces, because not only will that allow some kids to leave who need and want to leave, but it will apply enough pressure to the system so that it will feel the need to improve.
I think we all know more or less, maybe we don't know how bad it is, but we know that educational performance is not so good. And you're right about test scores, but when it's such an extreme result, like nobody at all showing proficiency in math, that obviously does tell us something.
Right.
I think people might not realize just how bad it is, but they know it's bad. But I think they think that this just means that we're not spending enough. I think that's easily disproven. How would you go about that?
Yeah, look, in Chicago, where you just mentioned, they spend over $25,000 per student per year. So get out of here with that. They don't spend enough. The private schools spend half the amount. I mean, per pupil, private school tuition and fees nationwide, at least, is about $12,000 to $13,000 per student per year. And the government schools, look, we've thrown more and more money at the problem. Again, like Connor said, expecting different results, and the results haven't gotten any better. Since 1970, we've increased per pupil education expenditures in the United States by about 152% after adjusting for inflation. Have the scores gotten 152% better? Obviously not. And we talk a lot about how this is like the teachers' union versus the kids' union, but the current system sucks for teachers too. I mean, over the same period that they increased per student spending by 152%, teacher salaries only went up by about 8% in real terms. What they did with the money was applied it towards administrative bloat and staffing surges, throwing more and more people into the system. It's a communist solution for the teachers union just to put more people into the buildings, which means more dues-paying members, which means a stronger voting bloc for the teachers unions, which means more power for them and more that they could do with elections. And that means more dues-paying members to pay Randy Weingarten's salary, who makes over $500,000 per year. So the money's not going to the kids. It's not really going to the teachers either. And so competition in the labor market would also help the employees, because employers would have an incentive to give them higher salaries and then to provide more autonomy as well. I mean, in the Washington Post, which is a horrible outlet, over the pandemic period, they wrote about a New Jersey school teacher that was in the public school system for decades, actually left the school system, started a micro school with about 5 to 10 kids in a household, and they ended up making more money than they were in the New Jersey public schools. And they really liked it because they had a smaller class size, only about 5 to 10 instead of 30 to 40 in the public schools. And they had more autonomy. They were able to structure the lesson the way that they wanted. And you know what? The parents voluntarily chose that teacher and voluntarily chose to pay them more and voluntarily chose to allow them to have more autonomy. So this is a benefit. It's a win-win for the families, obviously, and the kids, but it's also a win for the employees that are doing a good job.
I want to share a paragraph from page 51 of your book. Because here we're talking about some of the content. Because we can have a very good conversation about the content in a typical educational curriculum. And some of it can be this type of critique that, yeah, they know what MAGMA is, but they don't know how to do their taxes. They don't know how to start a business. They don't know how to figure out what niche they should be in. All these basic things that you would think, especially in the internet age, they would be trained in, they get none of that at all. They get a lot of information they're never going to use again, and that we all know everybody forgets a year later anyway. So we can have that conversation. But there's also the content conversation about the crazy stuff they're being taught, even outside the irrelevant material that they get taught half the time, is the crazy stuff. So, of course, we have gender theory being pushed on kids, sometimes secretly, but then also the critical race theory stuff. And this is the thing I want to share, because on the one hand, we had all these assurances that critical race theory is not being taught in the schools. So then, okay, so we called their bluff and said, okay, so then I guess you won't mind if we ban it then, since it's not being taught. And then it was like, what the heck? So here's the paragraph. That didn't sit well with the teachers' unions. The National Education Association passed a resolution in response saying they, quote, oppose attempts to ban critical race theory and or the 1619 Project, unquote. And they would promote curriculum that, quote, critiques empire, white supremacy, anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, racism, patriarchy, cis-heteropatriarchy, capitalism, ableism, anthropocentrism, and other forms of power and oppression at the intersections of our society, unquote. Now, there's nothing mainstream about that statement. And anthropocentrism, is that the idea that maybe if there's a burning building and there's, I don't know, a raccoon in there and a child, you might prefer to rescue the child? I mean, Jeez. Is that what they're saying?
I think it ultimately is what they're saying, because what we see from the teachers' unions, including the National Education Association that you just read a portion from one of the resolutions, they're extremely left-leaning. There was another resolution that actually failed where some of the delegates were trying to say that the NEA, this teachers' union, will make student learning the priority of the association. And so that was defeated. They voted it down. They said, no, it's not going to be the priority of the association. And so these unions and so forth, they're no longer, like, in my estimation, they're no longer these kind of inspiring, impartial educators. What we end up with is a lot of activists who see the classroom not as an opportunity to challenge ideas and learn together, but as a soapbox upon which to elevate their own platform. And so when you see the resolutions coming out, especially the one you read, Tom, and all the crazy jargon that's thrown in and so forth, like, it becomes very clear that parents who don't want their kids to expose to these crazy societal trends and propaganda and so forth need to find alternatives. And COVID was great in the sense that it woke so many parents up to the reality of the situation, with especially Zoom school, and parents were realizing what their kids were being taught. They're like, oh my gosh, this is garbage. I want to homeschool them or do a pandemic pod or whatever. And so it was great for that reason. And yet, that was just a small dent. I mean, homeschooling for a while almost tripled. It settled back down a little bit, still bigger than it was. But the purpose of our book, if there is one, is to basically be another wake-up call, because in my estimation, at least, and I think Corey will agree with this, too many parents fail to realize just how bad things are. They feel like, oh, I went to school and I turned out fine. And like, they don't realize that the schools today are so much more different, in part because of things like you read, where, you know, their activism opportunities for these teachers. And so we're trying to get parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles to say, you got to realize the nature of the problem before you can then be motivated to go on search for solution. There's all kinds of solutions out there, especially post-pandemic, especially with abundant information online, free and accessible to learn. There's all kinds of solutions, but parents aren't going to go searching for them if they don't realize that things are really bad. And my final point here is that I think that our decline towards mediocrity has been like the proverbial frog in a pot of boiling water, to the point where so many parents have become acclimatized to the mediocrity. They themselves were graduates of it, that we haven't realized the contrast of how far we've slid until you go read something, and we quote this in the book, like a late 1900s eighth grade test where they're having to do all these crazy questions that no adult could answer today without using like ChatGPT or something. It should be, you know, possible. But then you see the decline, that if eighth graders were being expected to learn this type of stuff so long ago, why is it that we have totally lowered? I mean, I hate quoting George W. Bush because I disagree with him on most everything, but he has this great quote where he talks about how these lowering standards in education are the soft bigotry of low expectations. And that's what has happened today. So many people are acclimatized to it. And so the book, the purpose is like, you're grabbing these parents by the shoulders and saying, wake up, it actually is pretty bad. You need to realize it.
Hey, everybody, I want to say a quick word on behalf of our sponsor, Policy Genius. I'm sure you've heard this word adulting. I don't know where this came from. Like maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, people started using the term adulting to refer to the things they need to do as an adult. And I don't like adulting. You know, I'd rather just be a kid again or whatever it is. Well, that word is like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. But one of the key aspects of adulting is making sure that people who rely on you are cared for, particularly in your absence. And I mean your ultimate absence. I mean the absence to end all absences. When you are dead and gone, those bills keep coming relentlessly. And you want to make sure that people who rely on you are cared for. That's why you need to get life insurance. Doggone it, you do. And Policy Genius is going to help you do that in a way that doesn't break the bank. In fact, you will be shocked at how inexpensive a lot of quality life insurance packages are. I enjoy tremendous peace of mind because I have an excellent life insurance policy that takes care of my family. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $25 per month for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer coverage in as little as a week and avoid unnecessary medical exams. No added fees, your personal details are private. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. If you don't mind, I'd like to parenthetically ask kind of a meta question about this whole project, because as you know, this stuff fascinates me. Connor, you have a big mailing list that you've built up by and large through the Tuttle Twins series. You have a track record of selling a boatload of books. So those two factors mean you could reach a lot of people. And Corey, you are a nationally known name. So it would seem that the two of you could easily have gotten a book contract from a major publisher. But instead, you chose to publish the book through the Libertas Institute. I assume that's not by accident. What was your thinking behind that decision?
Well, as the driver of the project, if you will, or initiator at least, I'll share my thoughts and Corey can add any of his. The biggest constraint that we had was the timing.
Yeah, it would take forever, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would take forever. And I've published with publishers before, and so I've kind of played in that ballgame. And just seeing the amount of time, the back and the forth, and then the editorial oversight and input and so forth. When we came up with this idea, and then I had to map out the timeline of what it would take to get the book out in time for then delivering to the Amazons of the world and then having it ready for the 40th anniversary, which was the end of April, we were kind of, even though I might have liked to consider that, I think we could have got a pretty decent contract given both of our backgrounds and our ability to market it. But maybe we would have gone that route had we thought up the idea a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how well we're doing already with the book sales and it not being like a major, you know, big five publisher. And I do agree we could have gotten one of them to agree to publish this book. But hey, it turned out well. We got it out quickly and it's moving along.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think the timing thing, I mean, this really is the time to strike rather than waiting the usual 1 year for your book to get on the shelf. I think you guys definitely did the right thing. And if you ever do decide to go with a big time publisher, you can use the great success you had with this book as further leverage to say, look, we know how to move books.
Corey, what do you think? How about 50th anniversary?
Let's go.
50 ways that the government continues to fail students 10 years from now. We got some lead
there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was really tough whittling it down to 40. Maybe it'll be a little easier next time around when we're doing the 50th anniversary.
Well, look, let me say also about the organization of the book. It's a bunch of really short, punchy chapters. So it is very readable. It is very convincing. In short order, you get a variety of topics covered with all the defense you would ever need of your position. It's extremely well done. So I actually want to focus on maybe what might be one of the more obscure topics you covered, but that does touch on my experience a little bit. I'll just tell you that when I was in elementary school, I was in one of the gifted and talented programs. And I remember in third grade, the teacher so encouraged me that I had my own textbooks. I was way ahead of everybody. So she would just give me textbooks from the higher grades and assign me work in that and just teach me advanced things, or rather hand me stuff and have me teach it to myself, which I thoroughly enjoyed doing. But by the time I got to sort of the end of elementary school, which would have been, I guess I would have been like, I hate to say this, but like 1982, but right around then, I was already seeing a trend whereby some of the teachers felt like the very existence of these programs or me having my own textbooks was a sin against egalitarianism, that all the students should have access to the things that I was doing, which I don't see why. Like in athletics, where I didn't excel as much, I wouldn't say, well, we should all be on the football team. Like, why would I say that? Right? But we all have different skills and whatever. So what has been the fate of these gifted programs over the years?
Well, some places are waging war against them in the name of equity. So you even have some states, I think it was Oregon, where the governor signed into law a rule that they no longer required you to read, write, and do math in order to graduate. I mean, so you're seeing this a lot. I think Virginia had one of the latest scandals as well, where they're hiding the National Merit Award results from the students in the name of equity too, because, oh, well, then they might be more likely to get scholarships to go to college. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's just lowering the bar for everyone, lowering expectations.
There was a Wall Street Journal article that, interestingly enough, came out on April 26th, which was the 40th anniversary of the report and the date of publication of our book, titled "Schools Are Ditching Homework and Deadlines in Favor of Quote-Unquote Equitable Grading."
Yeah.
And so this is getting to what Corey's talking about, where so many of these schools are feeling like, well, we have to, I'm trying to remember, I think it was called 2084 by Harrison Bergeron. Does that sound familiar? Kurt Vonnegut wrote this. It was this short story about how these like ballet dancers were so beautiful, but they had to like wear weights and things like this to handicap themselves so that they would be on par with everyone else. So it's this kind of dystopian commentary on this exact type of like equity crap that we're seeing today. And so, Tom, my experience mirrors your own. I was in a gifted program in elementary school, didn't really have those advanced tracks later on. I don't think it was part of any of this equitable grading. I think a lot of what we've seen across the country is it's more of a funding issue, which is hilarious because we're just throwing so much money at these schools, but they're getting absorbed into administrative overhead rather than directly to the classroom and teaching these kids. So a lot of programs have been shut down or they've been consolidated. And in 2008, there was a survey of teachers where 80% of them agreed with this statement, quote, "Getting underachieving students to reach proficiency has become so important that the needs of advanced students take a back seat." And so that then mirrors my own experience as well later in high school, where I just found stuff boring. It wasn't really challenging. I'm a quick learner. I'm able to grasp concepts quickly, but I want to go at my own speed and pursue things where they take me. But that wasn't how it would work in the school. And so I was always having to listen to the teacher repeat the same thing for Johnny or Susie who didn't understand it. And I started to dislike learning. It wasn't until after college where I really began to appreciate education and learning because I had been so turned off by books and tests and homework and so forth. And so the nature of the system is such that we're combining all these kids, not based on academic ability or interest and curiosity. We're combining them based on the approximate, like the relative date at which they exited their mother's birth canal.
Yep.
Like, okay, you kids are all, you know, you share birthdays within a few months of each other. We're going to lump you all together in this classroom. It just doesn't make any sense. And so that's one of the critiques of the system is it's not designed to allow gifted students to excel and thrive.
I want to skip ahead to page 157. You have a chapter called Not, Quote, College Ready. One interesting thing about this chapter is the polling data about the percentage of students who think they're ready for college after high school. It reminds me of years and years ago, I think it was probably close to 30 years ago, American students and Korean students were polled as to whether they consider themselves good at math. And more than half the American students, of course, thought they were good at math. And the Korean students—
were good at confidence.
Yeah, they're good at confidence. Exactly right, Corey, because the Korean students are way better at math, but they don't think they're any good at it, according to the polls. Well, likewise, a lot of these students are not college ready. And you have this anecdote on that page about a student saying to the professor in a, I guess, a remedial math class, look, the answer I'm getting is 1/10, but the computer is saying 0.1. And the teacher has to explain, well, that's the decimal equivalent of 1/10. So one way to know that mediocrity is the norm is the percentage of students who have to take one form or another of remedial courses in college.
That's right. I'll kick it to Corey after just mentioning this brief bit on the bullet point. So nearly 80% of students say that they believe that they were ready for college when they left high school. What's fascinating about this is nearly 40% of students at two-year schools and a quarter of those that are at the four-year schools, they fail to complete their remedial classes. Hundreds of colleges across the country are placing more than half of incoming freshmen in at least one remedial course. Remedial is just a fancy word for saying you're taking high school classes once again in college because you're not necessarily prepared. And so we're creating this conveyor belt, pumping all these kids from K to 12 into college, but they're not ready. We're spending, I think it's around $7 billion in taxpayer dollars, not to give higher education to these K to 12 graduates, but to give them remedial education. And even then they're often failing either at 25 or 40% based on which school they're going to. So it's very depressing to see that with all the taxpayer expense that's being funneled into the system, the quality of output is shockingly low.
At the same time, we're pushing the lie in schools all across the country that everybody needs to go to college to be successful, and we're ignoring the trades where kids can make more money directly out of high school and not have all the debt that is associated with college. I mean, you have people graduating from college with their degrees and then going to work at Starbucks with a ton of debt, which is, I would say, an overall net loss. So, I mean, this really gets back to one of the inherent problems in the system is that it's one size fits all, that we push the same message to all the students, regardless of their abilities and regardless of their interests, and we shuffle them along through the system just based on how old they are with people in large class sizes. Yeah, the teacher's trying to teach. It's the most difficult job possible where you have students with differing ability levels in the same classroom and telling the teacher to try to figure it out to teach them all at the same pace and to get them to the next grade level. It's just a total disaster. And this is also why we've seen these curriculum arguments sprout up over the past few years, is because parents are just inherently going to disagree about how they want their kids raised. And in the current system, you got to have some group forcing their opinions about how that ought to look on other parents. That's never going to work, this one-size-fits-all system in a society where people just fundamentally have differing opinions about how they want their kids to be raised and to be educated. And so the only way out of this mess is from the bottom up. Homeschooling your own kids or through school choice initiatives like education savings accounts to allow families to take their kids' education dollars to providers that best meet their needs and align with their values. A lot of these problems that we point out are the result of a one-size-fits-all system that will never be remedied by tweaking that current system. It has to be a structural change from the bottom up.
I actually think this book fills an important gap, because one of the toughest sells, I think, as a libertarian is convincing people that there's another way to think about education, because they think it's too expensive. There's no way anybody could do it outside this system. Yeah, it has its problems, but it's better than nothing. And it's better than what you crazy, greedy libertarians would do to us. You'd be forcing the poor into serfdom and they would all be illiterate. I mean, like, we already know that. I mean, this is a tough sell. And what you show in this book, it's just relentless, short little chapter after short little chapter, showing that it's not just one problem or a set of minor disappointments. It is just this, to the point where you're begging for mercy by the end of the thing. So it's a very, very, very important book, because I think it can have the effect of opening people's minds. And what I'm getting at here is that in your last chapter, you don't have a triumphalist ideological conclusion. At the end, you say, look, obviously we can see there are tons of problems here, but today you have more options than ever. So the whole thing is not like at the very end, everybody pull your kids out of the system and do this one thing. It's instead saying there are a whole lot of options. And in light of the disasters we've talked about in this book, we hope you take some time to examine those options. I think that's just the right tone for something like this, rather than the ideological screed that we might be tempted to put at the end.
Well, it was tempting, as you described, Tom, because it would be easy to get up on the soapbox. And Corey and I are both very passionate about these different alternatives and solutions. But ultimately, we didn't want this to be a solution book. Those are out there. There's all kind, you know, how to homeschool or how to start a micro school or how to, you know, whatever. those are out there. What we realized is that so many parents are on the fence sitter or their head buried in the sand. They think, oh, I went to school. I turned out fine. My kids will be okay. We wanted to, kind of like you said, machine gun fire, just barrage them with so many of the problems so that they feel overwhelmed into accepting the reality of the situation, not this pseudo reality that we concoct for ourselves. And then they're going to be motivated to go search for the solutions. And they're out there, and Corey's organization and mine and many others will eagerly be there to support those parents in finding what works for them and their family. But we can't get them to want to do that until they realize just how deep and broad the problems are. So fundamentally, this is a book exposing parents and adults to the problems, their significance, their substance, and just how long-standing they have been, and that we've been accepting this for far too long. So it's time to change.
Yeah, I think Connor hit the nail on the head. This is a problems book as opposed to a solutions book. And people will start looking for these solutions. They already have started looking for the solutions. They already, homeschooling has surged in recent years. And so has charter school enrollment, and school choice victories are just blossoming all across the country, particularly in red states. So I think the natural next step is for families to ask about what those solutions are. Hey, Connor, perhaps we'll come up with a fancy title as a sequel to this book, as Solutions to the Failing Government School System Today. So yeah, I think that actually might be a project we want to embark on pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, this has been a great effort. And I like to remind people that if you like your public school, you can keep your public school. After reading all of these things and having your eyes opened about the problems inherent in the government school system, every single school choice initiative allows the public school option to be on the table. So if you want to keep sending your kids to these institutions that are indoctrinating with ways that aren't aligned with your values, you are free to do so. But hey, there are some other options too.
Well, the book is Mediocrity, 40 Ways Government Schools Are Failing Today's Students. I've got it linked at tomwoods.com/2325. I read and talk about a lot of books on this program, but I really, really like this one. And I know some of you are cursing old Woods here, that you've already got a stack of books. Okay, just throw a blanket or something over that stack and start on this one. Because just when you think you've got it all figured out as to what all the perverse incentives might be in the existing school system or what the problems are, you don't know the half of it until you've read this book, Mediocrity. So congratulations, gentlemen, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate the support.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.